gentlemen. Today is Monday, March 20th. Happy spring, everybody.
Monday, March 20th. Happy spring, everybody.
Can I get in the loop? Can I get in the loop? Loop, loop. Check.
We might not start until we get these guys up here.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
That was kind of fun.
That was, I feel like I was in one of my teenagers' boomerang things or something like that. All right. We all good? All right. Good. Thank you. Today is still Monday, March 20th, and still happy spring, everybody. I'm opening. No, I think we have a reason, Eric.
Do you think there's a reason?
Yeah, Tamara fixed it.
What?
It was Tamara.
It was Tamara, don't worry.
Okay, it's Monday, as I've said several times now, both real and virtually, and it's acting like a Monday. And
Senator, I have to reboot.
You have to reboot. Okay, then we're going to start again. You'll let me know when you're ready, Eric. Monday, March 20th, 2017. Happy spring. I am opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we'll be considering House Bill 5021, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Ms. Barley.
Did you open the hearing?
I did open a public hearing. I'll open a separate public hearing. Thought I did, but not.
I am confused too, Madam Co-Chair. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, visiting you today and providing information about the budget is the agency called the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Unlike the DHS hearings, we'll be doing a presentation from the agency, from the Chief Financial Office, and then we'll have to leave some time for public testimony. And last time I checked, we had four people signed up to testify, just for timeline
context.
Thank
you. Appreciate that.
In OLIS today, you'll see the LFO budget review for the agency, as well as the agency's governor's budget binder, materials from the Chief Financial Office. The agency has this PowerPoint presentation on the screen, and there's also some supplementary materials from the agency on its programs.
Great. Mr. Steele, come on up. Whoever else is joining you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. The floor is yours.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Fred Steele. I am the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman and Director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. This is my first budget presentation. I want to say I do want to make a quick note. I feel honored to have the privilege to do so and do my first presentation in front of a seasoned ombudsman and Senator Winters, and appreciate the opportunity to talk about our two ombudsman programs and our public guardian program. Up here with me is Tony Larson, our residential facility ombudsman, Travis Wall, our state public guardian, and of course Tamara Brookman, I think you know, down at the end, who caused our technical difficulties.
We're never going to let you forget that, Ms. Brookman.
Under the bus.
Just to quickly, the overview of what we're going to go over this morning. I'm going to provide an overview and fairly quick overview of where we're at with our state agency, as with our three programs that we have now. I will go over the long-term care ombudsman portion of the program, turn it over to Tony to talk about the residential facilities ombudsman program, and Travis Wall for the public guardian. And then we also have with us this morning the chair of our residential facilities advisory committee, who has stuck out here in Western Oregon since last, Wednesday evening when she got here from Baker County, where she lives and resides, but is the chair of our advisory committee. So getting into the presentation and looking forward to the questions and discussion this morning, I wanted to start with the organizational chart, which is, example of creativity with a small agency. From 1985 until 2013, we were just the long-term care ombudsman program, with the addition of two new programs, with Tony and Travis's programs. We've had to get somewhat creative in division of labor, for myself effectively serving in two roles as the long-term care ombudsman and also director of the agency. We were afforded, when the public guardian as the third program was added into the agency, we were afforded a deputy director type position to focus on the operations of the agency, be our chief operations officer, financial officer, informational officer, essentially. We don't use those terms, but that's just to put some context on it. Particularly, I want to spend a little time talking about our mission. And as an agency with two ombudsman programs, there's a natural relationship. I mean, it's just a natural approach with who we are and what we do as two ombudsman programs. With the addition of the Public Guardian program in 2014, it caused us as an agency to some degree to take a step back and reflect on who it is, or what our mission is in serving Oregonians, to find that common ground between advocacy programs of ombudsman work that we do with our residential facilities and long-term care ombudsman programs, with a program that to some degree is providing a service to Oregonians in the Public Guardian program. And in some ways, it feels to us as a no-brainer at this point of what we're focusing on, but it's reflected here in the mission statement of really looking to protect the individual rights, promote independence, and ensure the quality of life of individuals. And that is the same whether it's an Oregonian being served by the Public Guardian program or our ombudsman programs. It is about the independence of the individual and trying to maximize that independence and focus on their rights. So in a care facility setting, their resident rights. As somebody being served by the Public Guardian program, the inherent nature of that program of taking rights away from an individual, you are being, whether it's public guardianship or private guardianship, a court is appointing somebody to make decisions for the individual, and you're effectively taking rights away from someone to make their own decisions, just that inherent rights of a human being, of an individual. But with a program that is built appropriately and properly, as is our state public guardian program, as it continues to build, it's actually recognizing that starting point, but trying to maximize beyond that, maximize the independence of the individual to the greatest degree possible, to emphasize their rights and preserve those rights and that independence as much as possible. So spending a little time on that just to reflect again our growing agency with the three programs that we have. So as far as a final slide on the agency and what we have, it's just starting point of our budget. In current biennium 2015 to 17, we're just over $6.9 million for our three programs combined. The current service level is reflected there, and with the 2017-19 governor's recommended budget, shows you to a degree what is being proposed, at least through the governor's office, potential cuts with that difficult task and chore of balancing the state budget, which is, as I understand it, now in your hands and the legislature's hands to make that balance. As an agency, 90% of our budget is general fund. And 10% is other funds. For the Public Guardian program, it's all general fund. The other funds come from the two ombudsman programs, and we'll get into that with our individual program reviews as we go forward here this morning. And I'm assuming there's no questions yet on the overall agency. Okay, so I'm going to dive into the long-term care ombudsman before I turn it over to Tony, and where we're at. And of course, this is at least for some of you, definitely Senator Winters, Senator Steiner Hayward, with your time on the subcommittee of Ways and Means, you're familiar with the long-term care ombudsman program, and I believe all of you have some level of understanding and knowledge of the long-term care ombudsman program. So this is a great overview of where we're at. So the starting point, or just the refresher, is that we are the advocates and effectively chief advocates as long-term care ombudsman for residents of nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, and adult foster homes. To categorize that a little bit further, these are the DHS, Aging and People with Disabilities licensed facilities. In those facilities, there are just over 44,000 Oregonians living in these facilities. As an ombudsman program, our focus is on the resident rights of the individual, with an emphasis on, or at least in my approach to the role, and again, I hadn't mentioned this, but did want to mention that I was appointed to as the state long-term care ombudsman in September 2015, so I've been in this role for about a year and a half now, and in the way that I tend to approach our rights work that we do on our advocacy for residents is looking at that inherent imbalance of power between the resident, who is dependent upon the living situation that they have, dependent upon the care that's being provided to them, and the inherent imbalance of power between the provider and owner of a building and the individuals providing staff and generally great staff around the state, the staff providing the care, to make sure that that individual living in the facility and receiving care in the facility can receive all of the care that they are entitled to, that they're supposed to be receiving, that's being paid for, whether by private pay or by Medicaid, but even more so, that they can live as if they were living at home, that they have the same rights as any individual living in their own home setting and can receive that care and that quality of life. And that's the focus of the long-term care ombudsman program. So I mentioned that I'd get into the budget just briefly, and it shows here on this slide that 81% of our long-term care ombudsman program is from general funds. The other 19% are other funds. A large portion of that is Old Americans Act, which is the foundation for the long-term care ombudsman program, and inserted into the Old Americans Act in the 1970s nationwide to create a state long-term care ombudsman for the resident rights protections that I've talked about. The other portion of the other funds is for a program called SMP, which stands for, at least used to stand for, Senior Medicare Patrol, to educate on fraud and abuse in Medicare, to educate Medicare beneficiaries. It's a joint program. It's a program that is funded at Department of Human Services, but with our volunteer corps in our program, as well as another program, the SHEBA program, the State Health Insurance Benefits Assistance, that we contract, and the three of us as Administration for Community Living type programs from the federal level, but the three programs coordinate on that beneficiary education for Medicare beneficiaries. Didn't mean to spend that much time on that. So the volunteers, and most of you up here, I think, understand the importance and value and the uniqueness of our program as a long-term care ombudsman program and being rooted in a foundation of volunteers. It amazes me, impresses me, and I feel honored to be able to work with these volunteers. And now we have over 190 volunteers serving in long-term care facilities, assigned anywhere from 1 to about 8 or 9 for some of our more seasoned volunteers, getting to know the residents in those facilities, working on issues of medication errors or just medication delivery in general, working on care planning, working on food issues, just being the voice for that individual to the point of getting involved in involuntary move-out and eviction situations. It's intense work that volunteers are providing, people that are just providing their time because they care. They care about their fellow community members that are living in these care facilities. And as of about 2 weeks ago, we trained and were finishing their certification of 16 more volunteers in the metro counties. And we still have a long ways to go to get up to a robust number for those volunteers and where they're assigned in their facilities. Because as of right now, we're only assigned in about 55% of nursing facilities, residential care, and assisted living facilities. And those volunteers do great work, but that's 45% of facilities in Oregon out of, and that's about 660 nursing facilities, assisted living, and residential care, where we don't have a volunteer, or 45% of those facilities where we don't have a volunteer assigned. And so we continue to do that recruitment. When I started about a year and a half ago, we were at about 150 volunteers, and we're now up to about 190. We've put a significant focus on the recruitment of those volunteers with the exceptional work that they do. And I'll mention, when our chair of our residential facility advisory residential facilities advisory committee comes up this morning, she is a certified ombudsman and has been for many years serving the Eastern Oregon counties, even beyond Baker County. Wanted to mention, could just point out a couple of the statistics that are on this slide in particular that advocated for an average of 138 residents. That's by average of what each volunteer does. When they start out, they're assigned just one single facility. But again, we have some seasoned volunteers that are serving in upwards of 8 facilities and getting to know all of those residents. But it averages out to about 138. So for every single volunteer that we have, we have a great statistic there of how many Oregonians are getting this advocacy service and right service. And then, of course, what these volunteers provide in number of hours. If those were FTE hours, it would cost the state about $1.75 million, at least in the last year. Or I think that might be the biennium number that we have there. As far as key accomplishments and some things to touch on, and for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program in the past biennium, but focusing more so on the past year in 2016, that we completed over 14,000 facility visits, and again, most of that being done by those volunteers, but also by our 7 deputy ombudsman staff in their regions. That's about a 5% increase from the year prior to that. And we have the graph there to show you the number of calls that are coming in. And if you go back a few years, you can see that we're receiving 800 more calls into our office. This is our 1-800 number. And these are calls and complaints coming in from the residents themselves or family members. It is increasing our workload significantly in office to the point we're having to do backup. We always have what's called a deputy on duty, somebody to take those calls. We've done some additional cross coverage in the last few months, the last 6 months, to supplement, just because the volume of calls from one day to the next, but the volume of calls can increase significantly. The resolution that's mentioned here is about 89%, which, if you look at our KPMs, is a fairly consistent in the last few years, around 90%. But one thing that I just wanted to mention, it says plus 65% over 2015. The reason for mentioning that is just to demonstrate some stability. There was changeover, as some of you are aware, in my predecessor, and when she left at the beginning of 2015, there was also a deputy ombudsman that left, and there was some significant high-level staff that weren't there to support the volunteers directly. It was just that transition phase in 2015. But this number here is just showing the stability and getting back to where we've intended to be, and that's a calendar year. Oh, I thought I was.
I apologize. Representative Malmstrom. I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
You're still supposed to be going along and super happy.
Probably taking too much time.
No, you're not. And I would just want to say, I would take, I mean, I'm glad Representative Malmstrom had the question, but frankly, I would take the fact that you're not hearing a lot of questions as a good sign.
Okay, great.
Not that we're not interested,
I'll accept
but that,
that
we're all well aware and nobody's really worried about you.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I realize that there's always going to be complaints, but can you give me an overview about what the types of complaints there are, and have that, those kinds of complaints particularly changed over the last biennium at all?
Co-Chair, is Representative Malmstrom, I think there's been some consistency in the last biennium of the complaints as far as what I've seen and what's presented in front of me. Our top three complaints are number one, and has been for a number of years now, are the evictions and involuntary move-outs, and sometimes those are very appropriate for individuals. I'd have to double-check the numbers, but it was probably about 250 involuntary move-outs of residents just last year across the four settings. These are people that, again, are, you know, have chosen to live there, and whether they've been there for a year or 4 years, want to live in this location and are having to move. Sometimes that's because their care needs have changed and they need to be in a different setting, but sometimes the reasons are other than that. Personality conflicts, maybe just to kind of generalize that, and the individual is being forced to move, and we can get involved in that. But again, and I kind of mentioned this a little earlier, some of the other complaints are medication related, could be delivery of medications, timing of medications, also care planning needs, disagreements between the resident and facility on what those care plans, you know, what a care plan need is for an individual resident. Food's always a top five complaint, and sometimes that's just what the food is, but sometimes it is dietary related. Sometimes it's the individual, as a great example, the diabetic that wants chocolate cake against medical orders, and the facility is trying to enforce the medical orders, but if you were living at home, you'd eat that chocolate cake regardless if that was your interest, and so we'd stand up for that individual to do so. And that's a very small issue, but that's just, you know, we'll have some of those food type complaints. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
Finally, and I mentioned this too, as far as being in 55% of facilities in the last year with our volunteers, the number when I was getting started in 2015 was about 45%. And so with the additional approximately 40 volunteers, we're in about 10% more of the facilities in the past year. And then finally,
thank you. What percentage of the complaints that you received do you refer to DHS or adult and people with disabilities or the senior side? Or do you? I know, I'm sure you do, but anyway, what percentage of them do you?
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, I will have to get that exact number for you, and I can do. We definitely refer abuse complaints and abuse situations to Adult Protective Services, whether that be at DHS or their area agency on aging partner that delivers Adult Protective Services. Same thing with licensing complaints, whether that's getting it to the appropriate regulatory entity for nursing facilities or assisted living residential care.
And my second question when you get back to the office, that what is the response time coming back from the agency back to the long-term care ombudsman and how and the resolution of the complaint?
And co-chairs and Senator Winters, again, I'd want to get an exact number for you if that's what you're asking, or at least a ballpark figure. I would say that in the past year, the response and collaboration between those entities has improved significantly. From what I understand, it being in prior years, some of that I would say is my predecessor, Mary Yeager, and a lot of great work and foundations that she built, but also in the new culture at Department of Human Services, wanting to collaborate with our office quite a bit more.
Fred, it would be helpful if you, when you provide the information back, that you'd also provide some trend lines as to from the agency as what is, you know, the question that I asked of how many that was sent to the agency, how many were founded, and what the percentage of, the, you know, and that timeliness in getting them back to your organization. That has been an issue for some time, not just with Yeager being there, but the resolution. From the agency, so it would be helpful because you've got a lot of new members on this panel.
Yeah, Co-Chair Senator Winters.
I see an old familiar face sitting out there in the audience too.
So thank you. Final slide for me before I finally get into Tony.
I have to clarify that. A chronologically advantaged.
I wanted to touch on something that we did in our office. You know, with two new programs, a lot of the work that they need to be accomplishing, you know, between our residential facilities ombudsman, public guardian, that's laid out for them. I mean, there's a lot of building those programs in the past year and the years to come. For the long-term care ombudsman program, and having existed for close to 40 years here in Oregon, one of the things that we wanted to be able to do, and when I got started at the office, was recognizing a need to better understand memory care settings and residents with dementia and how we can be providing better advocacy for residents with dementia and recognizing that they don't make the same complaints. That was something that is very low in our office. Looking at the aging of people with disabilities presentations last week to your committee, I know they had commented on that abuse is higher in those settings, and that's my understanding too, as far as what's being reported and investigated. But for complaints to our office, for resident rights issues, dementia settings, and endorsed memory care in particular, we don't get the same volume of complaints that we do in every other setting. And
I'm sorry, let me ask you a question about if you're going to, you may be able to say it, but. Do you think, I mean, clearly the people who are residents in those settings would have many more challenges making complaints directly. Do you think that too many of their family members are unaware of what's happening or of their ability to reach out to your office? Or do you think that, God forbid, too many of them don't have somebody who is of sound mind looking out for them? Or why do you think that is? Because clearly they're going to be less likely to complain about chocolate cake or no chocolate cake, but obviously there are going to be issues. I mean, we've all been in them, and we've all known people who've lived there in those places. So
yeah, and Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, My understanding of, really comes down to the resident. And I use that chocolate cake as an example of the food.
Sure.
As, you know, it's a great rights advocacy kind of example. But maybe a better example is even the assistance with toileting situation, where a resident is left on the toilet for 20 or 30 minutes because there's a lack of staffing in a facility for any given day. And maybe that's because that's the staffing level that's being provided, but maybe somebody called in sick at the facility and there's no backup coverage like you would have in a school for a substitute teacher. Those are getting into larger issues, but for that individual resident in another setting, we'd probably get the call from that resident. For somebody in dementia, I don't think we get those calls, and those add up significantly over the course of a year of the calls that we don't get from the resident themselves.
Representative Alonso Leon.
Yeah, so thanks, Fred, and I appreciate your presentation. And I know in our conversation when we met in my office, we talked about some of the potential challenges around language barriers, right? I'm assuming that as you recruit for volunteers, that they're also bilingual in cases where some of these folks can't speak English, and it would be challenging for them to ask for help if they can't speak the language, right? Do you have an idea of how many volunteers you have that are bilingual, and do you have an idea of how many folks don't speak English that are in these facilities?
And co-chairs, Representative Alonso Leon, thank you for the question. Since we met last week and had a discussion a little bit around this scenario, and there's multiple aspects of it, and I say scenario, I mean, is it real life for individuals that don't speak English? I don't have the specific number, but I know, I was assured that we do have volunteers that are bilingual, but I'm not aware of us intentionally placing them in facilities that have, bilingual needs. What we do have, and what I confirmed last week, is that we have five of our posters. So every facility is required to have a long-term care ombudsman poster in their facility, and we have five other languages that those posters are converted into, so that an individual, especially in, whether it be a more predominant, higher Asian population or Hispanic population, but those that cannot speak English population in a care facility, that we have that poster up in that facility as well, so that they can call. I will admit that the one thing that I, after our conversation and learning, inquiring more at our office, is that we, there's been a disconnect recently that I wasn't aware of, so we're in the process of fixing that, is that, as I understand it, there is a service, I believe, provided by the Department of Administrative Services, that when we have somebody call in that clearly doesn't speak English or isn't responding to English questions from our receptionist, that we can patch it over quickly to a translation service. Apparently, there's been a disconnect, though, and that hasn't been occurring. So I will admit I was a little horrified when I found that out after our conversation. I went back to inquire. Instead, what has happened a couple times recently is Tony Larson, our residential facilities ombudsman, who is bilingual, has been brought up to help out on the phone. She's not always around, and she's building up a program, and that's not a solution, but I guess that's what's happened recently. So we're in the process of fixing that. As far as the demographics of non-English speakers in facilities, it's that's something that I'd have to check with the Department of Human Services, Aging People with Disabilities, to see if they keep those statistics. But we can look into that, and I can work with Ashley Carson Cottingham and her staff.
Yeah, follow up.
Please.
Thank you for following up and checking on that. I know when I worked for the state as a GED administrator, we used the same company or some sort of translation agency. But what happens is when folks call and somebody says, wait a minute, I'm going to get a translation company, people get impatient on the other end or feel like they're not being thought of and hang up, and so we lose that person. And that, my understanding, people stopped calling our office because there wasn't somebody who spoke their language. When I came on board and started speaking in their language and answered in their language, we got tons of calls, particularly in Spanish, because I don't speak a third language other than my parents' indigenous language from Mexico that I only understand and don't speak. But it makes a difference when you have a human person answering the call in the language that makes sense for them. And that makes it so much easier to connect and explain their situation. So if there's any way in respect to capacity or volunteers answering those lines and being able to answer questions in their language, I recommend or make a strong suggestion that we make an effort to do that, because it does make a difference for our folks.
Yeah, co-chairs Representative Alonzo Leon fully agree. I also had provided the related example, and I think we need to make a better effort in our ombudsman programs to provide that direct non-English speaking services and just be a little more coordinated about it in care facilities. I did provide the effort that we've had in the last 6 months, and really we were just fortunate to have a prospective volunteer reach out to us in a facility for deaf residents and the need for sign language, and we actually have a volunteer assigned to that facility now in the eastern Multnomah County, it's in Multnomah County area. So that was a targeted effort, and we were fortunate to have the individual reach out to us, but it was a perfect match. So that's something that we did do in the last 6 months, but need to do a little bit more with the non-English speaking, I would agree. So with the time that I have, and I've gone way over my time, I wanted to make sure that you guys hear from Tony Larson and Travis Wall and their programs equally as important as long-term care ombudsman. So I'd be happy to talk to you a little bit more in the near future about the memory care study that we did and the findings. And we're actually still compiling those findings, but this slide provides some of the overview of what we did as far as work. And again, volunteers. The volunteers were doing pretty much 90, 95% of this work. Because they're amazing. So let me turn it over to Tony at this point, and thank you.
Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward and Representative Rayfield and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Tony Larson. I'm the Residential Facility Ombudsman. Our program is new, as you can see. While we were established in 2013, I was hired in September of 2015. And so the numbers that you see this morning reflect the program actually opening with deputies and doing outreach to homes as of July 1st. And these numbers are already a little bit behind on what we've done in outreach that you'll see. But it represents quite a bit of work in the 7 months or so that we've been open to individuals. The homes that we cover are for intellectual and developmental disabilities and mental health conditions, so those that are certified or licensed. It excludes these secure facilities for mental health as well as drug and alcohol. It does include 24-hour residential homes that are licensed for up to five individuals. There are a handful of homes in the state under 10 that are licensed for more than that for developmental disabilities. Mental health homes as well, ranging in size from 1 to 5, and then facilities are considered 6 and above, 6 to 16. We also cover foster homes for developmental disabilities and mental health for adults as well as children. We're serving just over 7,800 residents now at 2,200 facilities. 220 of those facilities are mental health. The rest would be for developmental disabilities. Our budget, we're budgeted at 96% from general fund. The 4% other are quality assurance funds coming from the state licensing agency for developmental disabilities. While mental health by statute has those corrective actions, they actually don't collect those monies. Since opening and bringing on staff, we currently have positions for 5 deputies. At the moment, we've hired for 5 as of about 3 weeks ago. We only have 4 on at the moment, so we've had actually teams of 2. We started in Eastern Oregon in July. We chose to do that in order to spend as much time as possible there. The individuals that reside in homes for developmental disabilities and mental health have different kinds of service needs. And while they need specific and very direct advocacy in order to reach folks and make the service available, we have to develop some different methods to do that in order to be available to people. And that means being available in person. And you mentioned earlier, Representative Alonso Leon, that the in-person speaking on the phone and talking to people is precisely the manner in which we're following services. And what we've seen so far in the complaints that we've received of the 320 total visits to those homes and the 908 individuals we spoke to, the calls for help come directly after we've done an outreach to a house. So simply turning on a phone and saying we're open for business and sending out posters is not really going to do that to reach folks. And I think we found that so far. The cases that we opened at 95 cases, only half of which have been resolved, kind of speak to the complexity of what it takes in those two very, very different systems in order to resolve issues for individuals. I'm happy to report that those have all been successful to date. But again, some have taken months to resolve, and it has taken a lot of systems work. For the Residential Facility Ombudsman Program, it doesn't have the benefit of 35 plus years of being in facilities and being known and being incorporated into how the system approaches and interacts. And so our challenges are significant. We didn't want to stop outreach to the homes before we built a foundation, and so we're struggling with doing that at the same time. That means opening up means of communication with the Department of Human Services, with the Office of Developmental Disability Services, with mental health, with the CCOs that control those homes and those certifications for mental health. Each one of those passes and each case that comes in requires work on many different levels in order to develop that communication, to be able to fix things at a systems level as well as for an individual. So that's where our work lies, actually, for the next several years. Our goal is to reach 100% of the homes. We're opening up one county at a time, but while we're doing that, we are accepting calls statewide. We have been able to sustain that and serve individuals across the state. But the rollout method that we're using in order to reach people is showing very good results, and it's allowing us time to actually spend with people. Over the next 6 to 8 months, we will be developing a very specific training program and recruitment for certified ombudsmen for residential facilities. And some very specific interested folks that want to spend time in some very small home atmospheres, which is the majority of the homes that we're talking about. Issues usually are not resolved at the house level. They usually have to go higher than that, which is what makes it a little more complicated. While we move through communities, we spend an awful lot of time on community outreach itself. And that includes what we call primary and secondary targets. So individuals that we know meet, go to the homes and visit the homes. So we go to fire and police, do outreaches there and presentations with them. We go to the local family groups, self-advocacy groups, and work with them very closely. We've had a lot of interest from self-advocates and peers in setting up a model program for certified ombudsmen, and that is something that we will pursue. It's been an exciting last year and a half, but I think we're making very good inroads. And at this point, we have we've concentrated on adults because, as I mentioned before, developmental disabilities system is not the mental health system, is not the children's system. They're all very three different things, and they require different kinds of supports and different kind of inroads on each. We have approximately 300 children's foster homes for developmental disabilities and about 37 24-hour homes for developmental disabilities. We will start working in that arena within the next 6 months as well. Do you have any questions for me this morning?
Let's continue.
Travis, you want to?
Sure. Good morning, chairs, and committee members. My name is Travis Wall, and I'm the Oregon Public Guardian. And I, of course, am the third program that's a part of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman and also one of its newest. My small staff of three individuals and I provide surrogate decision-making, life management, and advocacy services to Oregonians who have limited or no ability to make decisions on their behalf. These Oregonians are probably the most at-risk adults in our state. Virtually everybody that we serve is at serious risk of harm because of their inability to make decisions. And in most circumstances, in virtually all circumstances, there's no one else available to serve as a guardian or a conservator for them. And I think some contextual information is probably useful at this point. Oregon has since 1971 provided counties with the authority to provide public guardianship services. But through the ensuing some 40 years, only two counties have actually stepped up and actually operate public guardianship programs, and that's Multnomah and Jackson County. So throughout the rest of Oregon, there are no public guardianship services. And in most parts of Oregon, particularly in eastern Oregon and southern Oregon, there's a very limited availability of what we call private professional guardians. Guardians that function on a fee-for-service basis to serve individuals who don't have a family member or a friend that can serve in that capacity for them. Guardianships, by the way, if you're unaware of this, are always court-appointed. It's a court-related process that's grounded in statute. It requires a finding by a court that an individual lacks the ability to make some or most decisions about themselves, and as a result, they're unable to manage their basic affairs. In those circumstances, the court may appoint a guardian or a conservator to manage either somebody's personal affairs or their financial affairs or both. The absence of public guardianship services has long been noted in Oregon, and there have been many efforts in recent years, really beginning in the mid-90s, to try to begin to do something about the lack of public guardianship services at the local level. There were task forces in Washington and Lane County that initially came together and endeavored to address this issue. There were also efforts at a state level. I was a part of a task force that you authorized, the legislature authorized in 2009 and met for the ensuing 4 years to look at this problem and try to address it. Many other neighboring states have long ago established public guardianship services and in fact provide services on a much greater basis than we do here in Oregon. The task force completed its work in 2012, and at that point the task force noted that somewhere between 1,500 to 3,000 adult Oregonians need but lack public guardianship services, and that these people are in harm's way every day because of the absence of public guardianship services. 2 years later, Senator Denbrough introduced legislation to try to address this issue, and that ultimately was passed. And in 2015, I was appointed and began to serve as a public guardian. What the legislature provided us at the outset was were the resources to really begin to build a program, but just that, not much more. And so with the resources that we had available, I, over the balance of the biennium, hired and trained and certified the three staff that serve with me and had begun to develop other parts of the program so that we can expand our services. But we remain a very small program, capable both directly through our staff as well as through contract resources of only serving roughly 5% of the people who need public guardianship services in Oregon. So we have already initiated services. We began to do that roughly a year and a half ago. We are present in actually some of about 12 counties at this point. Give me a moment here. So over the past year and a half, we've responded over 160 direct inquiries for assistance. We've made 35 plus diversions of persons to less restrictive alternatives. We've performed over 35 comprehensive guardianship and conservatorship evaluations. We've processed over 25 referrals from our high-risk teams. I'll say more about them in a moment. And we have filed over 22 petitions for temporary and continuing guardianship. We've been appointed to serve as a guardian for 15 protected persons residing in 10 counties. In addition, we have been working with DAS procurement to develop contracts for providing guardianship services in several counties, as well as to acquire the case management and accounting software we need to have to manage people's cases and to manage their estates. As I mentioned a moment ago, we've hired three staff. A key element of our development has been trying to, in addition to providing direct services in a targeted number of counties, has been to developing the infrastructure necessary to provide services in the least restrictive manner possible and in a thoughtful and responsible way. So one of the things that we have endeavored to do is to develop what we're calling high-risk teams in some five or so counties. These are teams that are comprised of different disciplines as well as different agencies across a given community that we bring together on a monthly basis to problem solve situations involving at-risk adults and whenever possible to try to find solutions other than guardianship. Guardianship is a very expensive, time-consuming, and intrusive way of serving people. So whenever we can serve people in a less restrictive manner, in a more efficient manner, it's desirable. We've had the teams that we've developed, the oldest of which now has existed for over a year and a half, have met over 50 times. And we feel very good about the work that they're doing, and you may hear more from others about them later today. Yes.
A question, you talked about guardianship as a restrictive manner. What is the less restrictive manner? You did not clarify.
Sure. Well, there are a variety of ways. One of which there is a new approach to assisting people with limited decision-making capacity called supported or assisted decision-making, where family members and friends and other supporters of an individual that lacks capacity are assisted in making decision. There are a whole variety of formal mechanisms from powers of attorney to advanced health care directives that can also be utilized to assist individuals.
A follow-up,
please.
Are you involved with the discussion on advanced directives?
I'm not directly involved with that at this point, but the agency is.
Yeah, co-chair Senator Winters, that is something that I've been directly involved with for the last couple of years, that conversation has been ongoing and what's culminated in Senate Bill 494 this session. I'd be happy to talk to you about it from our perspective.
I'd be happy to talk to you about it.
Great. I'd be happy to hear a little bit more about your perspective on it at this hearing, unless you think that's inappropriate.
I guess, what is there a question that it, and I don't want to take too much time away from, I know there's public testimony, we have our chair of our committee.
We'll hold on that.
Okay, right. Oh, thank you. More than happy to talk about
it. You're probably talking about a whole afternoon.
Yes, I think so.
Probably true.
Yeah.
I think it's very good for all of us to hear how closely you've been involved in the process. Thank you.
Well, again, Don. Chairs and committee members, we are committed to the utilization, as I say, of less restrictive alternatives whenever possible. And and actually, my background, not only have I served as a public guardian here in Oregon as well as elsewhere, I was the public guardian in the state of Utah for a number of years where I developed their program as well. But I have also worked as a disability rights advocate as well as a long-term care ombudsman in other states. And I have long championed the idea of doing everything we can to serve people in ways other than guardianship, and only to utilize it as a last resort. And so one of the other elements that we've pushed forward as we've begun to develop and roll out our program is doing everything we can to see that the due process protections that are afforded individuals that are facing the prospect of guardianship and who are subject to guardianship are honored, and in fact, those due process protections be strengthened, because we find that in some respects they're lacking here in Oregon. Again, coming back to these high-risk teams, they're a key element in what we're endeavoring to do to roll out the program. It's very important to develop the capacities in the program to address the issues that these individuals face. So often guardianship is implemented because there's a failure of our systems to adequately meet the needs of people because of the gaps and limitations that exist in our service systems. So bringing these teams together is part of our effort to try to identify those problems whenever possible and head off those situations that would otherwise require guardianship. Let me turn, if I can, to several cases that we've been involved with, because I think they speak to the incredibly important need of the services that we provide. Again, I think it's really important to remember that the people that we serve are the most vulnerable and dependent adults in Oregon. These are the most at-risk individuals. Sad to say, when we talk about public guardianship, we're talking about the end of the line. There is virtually all other options have been exhausted in trying to serve people.
How do you identify the individuals that you're providing the service to?
Chairs and Senator Winters, we identify them through a variety of mechanisms. One primary mechanism is Adult Protective Services. Because oftentimes the people who need public guardianship are being abused, neglected, or exploited, or they're at imminent risk of that. These multidisciplinary teams, these high-risk teams that I'm talking about.
I'm going to take you back, because just assuming that none of us know your processes. So you receive referrals from Adult Protective Services, and then that's what activates your involvement?
Senator Winters, anyone can make a referral to us, but generally speaking, and again, what we generally hear from are folks from Adult Protective Services. We often hear from hospitals. We often hear from...
So how many cases have you had in the last 2 years?
Cases is a term that I'm not certain I can talk about in... We have 15 individuals that we're serving as guardians for, but many more individuals that we have diverted. That again, through the efforts of our staff and through our high-risk teams, we have found other alternatives than guardianship for them.
If I was to do an audit of your program, what would that tell me?
It would tell you that we are saving a substantial amount of money because we have sought whenever possible.
How much?
I'm sorry, I can't give you a number of that, but I can tell you of a case in which we have intervened on behalf of an individual that had been in the hospital over 200 days last year, And if we had not intervened, that person would continue to be in the hospital today. The hospital stays are roughly cost roughly $2,500 a day.
What I'm trying to get at, trying to get at you, you know, to actually walk us through actually the universe of what you do in guardianships. I was a part of the work group when we did the legislation. And so just to tell me in generalities how well you're doing, I would like to know how many, what happens, and what have you within the scope of what you do. Whether you had 5 individuals, 20 individuals, 150 individuals, but what is it that Oregon is doing to make this population safer, to making certain that this vulnerable population is getting the service and counseling and individual that they need? So that's what I'm trying to get to.
Mr. Wall and Senator Winters, if I may, I think that what you've asked is a very important question, and I'm sure you have really good data to help answer it. It would probably be most helpful to this committee if you'd prepare a written response with a little bit more detail about the total number of cases that you guys have been involved with since the legislation passed, the different paths that some of them have taken, you know, a little bit more detail in the information. I think it would be helpful to have that as part of the written record, Mr. Wall. So would that be helpful to you as well, Senator?
That would be very helpful.
So if you're willing to, I'd rather hold your response to that and just ask you to submit that information to the committee. Ms. Byerly can work with you and the chairs to clarify that. Thank you in advance for doing that.
You're welcome. I'm sorry, would you, chairs, members, would you care for me to continue with my comments? Or?
Yeah, sure. I'm just trying to be sensitive to the fact that your board chair wants to testify, and we now have 5 people signed up for public testimony, and we only have 25 minutes. So do please continue with the rest of your presentation, and then we'll keep moving.
Okay. Well, I think at this point I will conclude my presentation. I was going to share with you examples of cases that we've been involved with because I think they illustrate precisely what Senator Winters is asking.
Yes, please. Please do provide those examples.
At this point, I'm sorry. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. The numbers you can provide in writing, but a couple of case examples would be great.
Sure. Okay. So first I'd like to speak about Joan Smith. Joan Smith is an elderly woman with a serious mental illness with decisional limitations who went without critically needed surgery for 2 years because the care facility in which she was living was unable to obtain the consent of her guardian, a professional fiduciary. Without the guardian's authorization, the hospital that was to perform the surgery was unwilling to do so. The facility contacted us after Joan's condition deteriorated and they could no longer reach the fiduciary. Joan had lost a number of her teeth. Her remaining teeth had decayed and had become rotted nubs and needed to be removed immediately. Joan was experiencing severe pain, had difficulty eating, could only consume soft foods, was experiencing recurring urinary tract and yeast infections, and her mental health condition was poor. We were well aware of the fact that when dental conditions deteriorate as far as they do, like in the circumstances with Joan, they can actually become life-threatening. Upon investigating Joan's situation, we learned that Joan's fiduciary had been arrested and was in jail awaiting trial in over 80 felony counts of abuse and exploitation of protected persons and others for whom she was responsible. We petitioned the court to dismiss the fiduciary and appoint us as Joan's successor guardian. The court agreed. Upon appointment, we arranged for the needed surgery. Post-surgery, we arranged for Joan to be fitted with dentures. In turn, we have gotten to know Joan so that we can and do make informed decisions on her behalf, participate in her treatment and care planning on a continuing basis. We regularly visit her in her Columbia Gorge facility in which she lives and monitor her care and treatment and are available on a 24/7 basis to address urgent and emergency business. Today, Joan's physical and mental health are much improved. We remain Joan's guardian. In another case, Rodney Adams. Rodney is a veteran with a serious and persistent mental illness who we found living in a home owned by his guardian, the same professional fiduciary that had been Joan Smith's guardian and was now awaiting jail, was in jail now awaiting trial.
The fiduciary that had provided Rodney with very little care and assistance, although she was charging his estate $3,600 a month for her services. As a result of her lack of attention, Rodney had lost considerable weight, had not bathed and changed his clothing in months. His hair was matted in knots, and his fingernails and toenails were so overgrown that one of his feet was at risk of harm. In addition, I'm sorry.
Have there been any criminal charges or accountability for this fiduciary?
Yes. So, again, the fiduciary actually, at the time that we became involved with the case, we came to find, had been arrested and was in jail awaiting trial. She has since been convicted and has been sentenced to a number of years in jail for the crimes that she committed, and she's also been ordered to pay restitution in a number of these cases. Unfortunately, quite honestly, in many of the circumstances in which people were harmed, there wasn't sufficient evidence to convict her of crimes in those cases, nor to order restitution for the harm or the losses that many others sustained.
Thank you. And the facility that these folks were in was closed?
No. This was, again, Joan and then Rodney's guardian. When we say guardian or conservator, we often use one word to refer to what might be both, which is a fiduciary. This was the individual that was responsible for both of these individuals. They were in care. Both of them lived in care arrangements at the time that the guardian was responsible for them. But the guardian's responsible for overseeing their care, making basic decisions for them, and ensuring that, in fact, they're provided with what they need.
So, to be clear, then, if Joan is living in some sort of I don't know if it was an adult foster home or an assisted living facility or what, but if she was in a care facility and was being neglected in this way, why, and if Rodney in particular, I mean, why would he have lost weight if he was in a care facility? I mean, it concerns me about the engagement in between the fiduciary and the care facility. I mean, did she tell the care facility not to care for these people, specifically instruct them not to care for them adequately,
right,
or what?
Well, again, there are complicated chairs, committee members. Again, there were complicating matters involved in both of these cases. Many of the cases that we're involved with actually are quite complex. Sometimes the failure to provide services or proper care is also complex. In relation to the situation involving Joan was in a skilled nursing facility. And unfortunately, as we were told, we came into the situation 2 years down the road, the care facility was unable to get the guardian to provide the necessary consent to provide the surgery. The situation at the outset was probably not a situation that was initially serious. She probably needed some basic dental care, and that wasn't getting done. But as time progressed, her situation deteriorated. The guardian continued apparently to fail to provide that necessary consent. OHSU, which was to perform the surgery, continued to decline to provide the surgery because they didn't have the necessary authorization. One can certainly, I think, draw a conclusion that the care facility should have taken more aggressive steps. But these issues are actually relatively complicated. There aren't clear mechanisms for individuals to communicate concerns to the court around the failure of a guardian to fulfill their responsibilities. So ultimately, what happened was is this situation persisted. When we came into the situation, it had become quite critical. The facility was not aware initially that the guardian had been arrested. This information, while public, was not widespread. And they were obviously at that point unable, because the guardian was in jail, to obtain the necessary authorization to get the surgery done at that point.
Okay.
And, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Representative Hayden.
Thank you. This subject is something I'm very familiar with. I happen to be a dental provider and hospital-based, taking care of adults and children with disabilities and age-related ideas or concerns. The consent is a huge problem in that arena. Often we don't have legal consent either from the caretaker or from family members, and so literally people's hands are taken and an X is marked. Doesn't seem to be a really efficient way to do that. I would like to see some development around how these consents can be provided to the healthcare provider. Also, one of the problems, a significant problem that we have is under the open card system, often the patients have medical care under an open card system, and they literally can't get a primary care physician in their area to do the history and physical that's required to be admitted to the hospital. And so there's some barriers around that that we're working with OHA on currently to try and get those issues resolved. But there's obviously a concern here, but even if you get the people in charge of their fiduciary responsibility or their caretakers really wanting to, it still could be very difficult.
Yeah. Please, I didn't know if she wanted to say anything, but yeah, Rep. Elstrom, and then we can see where we go from there.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I understand that, you know, things like surgery consents can be complicated, but you're describing somebody that's in a care facility and their hair is matted and they haven't bathed in ages. Why do they need a consent for their caretaker to bathe them and groom them?
Okay. Again, chairs, and committee members. Again, let me back up in relation to Rodney. Rodney was actually living in a home owned by the fiduciary when we found him. The home is not a licensed facility.
Oh.
It was a care arrangement, for lack of better words, that the guardian had made. A rather suspicious one, because guardian should not otherwise profit from the services they provide to an individual. And in fact, Rodney was being charged a substantial amount of money.
Right.
It's at the point that we found Rodney, the guardian had been in jail for at least several weeks, perhaps longer. So there was a care provider in the home, and I believe that I may be wrong that her husband may have lived in the home as well at that point, but clearly Rodney was not getting the attention that he needed. And in fact, after we became Rodney's guardian and we had him admitted to a hospital because we were very concerned about his health, because in fact he had lost substantial weight, Rodney was diagnosed as being in a failure to thrive condition. He's since recovered, but yes, this was very serious matter. And I want to underscore this, you know, what occurred with this guardian, because this in fact is a case that has involved much of our time over the past 2 years. And it has slowed the rollout of our program, because we, in developing our program, anticipated initiating services in a number of target counties, where we have in fact begun to do. But our ability to do that was completely slowed by our need to address the need of these individuals. And when we became involved with these individuals, it was not evident that anyone else was going to step up to the plate. Again, remember, there are no public guardianship services, but in two counties in the state, there are very limited private guardianship arrangements. And many of the individuals that we're talking about that were served by this fiduciary, and she was in business for some 8 years, were individuals that were referred to her by public parties. Because, again, quite frankly, there was no place else for them to refer individuals to.
Okay. Obviously, this is a subject that requires a lot more discussion than we have time for, unfortunately. I want to make sure we explore this at the depth we need. We may ask to meet with you separately, Mr. Wall, and have a little bit more of a conversation. I personally am a little bit puzzled about where the role of Adult Protective Services comes in a case like this, and where your role comes, your division's role comes in. But I don't think we have time to get into that into detail. I think the two cases you've provided have been illustrative of the complexity that you're trying to make sure we understand and the challenges facing your division. We do need to explore this a little bit further. We'll look forward to getting those details from you and then probably having some more conversations the offline. I do want to make sure that we have a little bit more opportunity to have your board chair testify and then members of the public, because we only have about 15 minutes left. So thank you so much. My apologies for having to cut you short, but I want to make sure that everybody else gets their chance. Thank you. Please.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Michelle Edwards, and I've spent 10-plus years as a certified ombudsman. I live over in the far northeast corner of this state, the snow zone, as I'm beginning to think of it. And I have served on the advisory committee now for 6 years, and the last two as chair. So thank you for your attention this morning, co-chairs and members. We're most appreciative of that. I've seen some of you in our committee meetings, and it's nice to see you again. Please, all of you are certainly welcome to attend, and we learn so much from you when you do. The committee, I'll just spend a moment on. We were 7 members. We grew to 11 members with the advent of the 2 new programs. We have 2 vacancies at the moment. They are both governor appointees. One will target for health, mental health, and the other for guardianship purposes. But I want to advocate, because that's what COs do, is we advocate. We advocate for our residents, and today I'm advocating for all 3 programs in the agency. And I do that with a great deal of pride. As you've heard, we provide, through our volunteers at this point, $175 million worth of wage services each year to this state. Our volunteers are proud of that. Each of our volunteers comes with life experience, training. In fact, to become a CO, we have to have more training than someone who administers a residential facility, such as an ALF, assisted living facility, or an RCF. We also have to have a number of hours each and every year to maintain our certification. Those folks do not. That said, you will see us. We come from our communities. We come from your communities. We might see you in church, at the library, the grocery store, most any place indeed around the community. And we care passionately about what we do. I think you all know that about us. But currently, we are resourced at only 65% of what this state needs in terms of deputy and agency staff. We are serving 70% of the population. We are still under-resourced. With greater resources and a greater balance, we can reach more. Someday, I'd like to see us reach 100% of those in various forms of residential facilities. We do it through the auspices of now 190 certified ombudsmen. You know, the number fluctuates, but roughly 200 is what we'd aim for at the moment. We covered 4,000 complaints. That's where we went out. We took the active complaint, and we sought to resolve it on behalf of the resident. Always we advocate for the desires of the residents. Sometimes we don't agree with it, but it doesn't matter. We're there as an advocate. A lot of times we may find ourselves in a family situation. I had 8 daughters and 1 mother in one, and that was interesting. Mom did not have a guardian or a power of attorney established, and she refused to sign the forms for Medicaid. So it was an ongoing process that did reach resolution and provided care for Mom. We've developed the specialty for memory care and trained 30 volunteers. They were in 49 specific placements, and you heard about that from Fred earlier, so I'm not going to go back over that. In terms of the public guardian, we have a very limited staff, as only 4, which you heard about from Travis, and they've been very busy with very complex situations. The model that they have developed, which is tailored really county by county, has been on a contract basis. However, as you know, should you wish to create FTEs and the appropriate resources, I know they're flexible enough to make that difference. In the residential facilities program, which you heard about from Tony, where we have 8,000 people to be served, residing in group or non home settings, that is their own homes. Each and every county, I think, has been heard from by that program. One of the individuals, when Tony's staff was rolling the program out across the state, they found was housed in a plexiglass room within a room, because 10 years earlier, it had been determined that that would be part of the appropriate treatment plan. You should know they are no longer in a plexiglass room. Likewise, locked doors, locked gates, various forms of overt restraint. That is, it inhibits the movement of the individual, thus creating issues of their rights being infringed upon, are not new in any part of this state. I am fearful that with Tony's program, as it gains more and more traction, has more and more face across the state, that we will find more and more infractions of human rights.
Ms. Edwards, I am so sorry, because I know how long you've driven. I would be very grateful if you could wrap up in just a minute or two so that we can have the opportunity for Ms. Brickman to do the presentation she has to do and then the public testimony.
I'll do that very rapidly.
Do we have to? I'm terribly sorry, because I know you've driven a long way to be here.
Madam Co-Chair, I'm pretty sure Ms. Brickman is okay with just having you look at the written testimony or the printed testimony.
That'd be very helpful.
And I think Fred already mentioned the governor's budget level. So.
Yeah, and Mr. Bartholomew and Ms. Repeteau, I don't know, but I'd prefer that you submit. Thank you very much for waving me off. Okay, good. So we're in better shape than I thought we were, but we still only have eight. Mr. Davis, I may ask the same of you, but we'll see, since you're pros at this. So Ms. Edwards, please.
Thank you. I'll wrap it up.
Thank you.
I'm going to tell you about a quick failure. It actually went on for months. It bears on the fiduciary that Travis was referencing. As I've said, I come from a very rural part. That fiduciary targeted rural parts of Oregon, where judges are overwhelmed with loads that are really quite remarkable. Gentleman named Frank. Frank was 97, he broke his shoulder. He came out of the hospital and some surgery, and he went into assisted living to complete healing. He had a power of attorney appointed. This had also been his caretaker, housekeeper person for 3 years. They had quite a good relationship. However, a son arrived, the only surviving member of the family other than Frank himself, arrived from the panhandle of Idaho and filed for guardianship. He had already had other legal interactions with his father. Frank was terrified of the man. An attorney was hired from a neighboring town. Frank did not get to meet with that attorney. It was hired by the son. They went to court. Frank did not want his son as a guardian. Therefore, this particular fiduciary was appointed. Frank was promptly transferred to memory care. There's nothing wrong with this man's memory. It was simply healing a broken shoulder. He was denied his right by this guardian to attend church. She stated she was fearful he would see people he would know. He probably would have, going to church. He was also denied the right to vote, to cast his ballot. It was an election year. We were able to, when I took the complaint, which came from all over the community, he was an old rancher. They've been there a long time. We could not get a hearing before the judge. People that had gone to school with the judge approached him, tried all kinds of things. The best I could do as an ombudsman for him was to assure the fact that he could take his meals with his friends in the assisted living wing. that he could attend social activities with that population. A few years later, I met Travis, and we have a public guardian program. Would that we had had it then. That said, I want to pull us back for 30 seconds to volunteering with a quote from an unknown person. Volunteering is the ultimate exercise in democracy. You vote in elections maybe once a year, but when you volunteer, you vote every day about the kind of community you want to live in. Thank you. May you all volunteer.
Thank you so much, and thank you for ending with that really inspiring quote. I'm going to start with Kendall Mason and Becky Strickland, and then hopefully have minutes, but I'm going to ask, you okay?
I can pass, yeah.
You can pass? Okay, Becky, you're up. Jim, come on up.
Jim Davis heard you.
Jim Davis, you want to come up?
Oh. he's chronologically advantaged.
Yeah. Great. Ms. Strickland, please.
Senator Hayward and Representative Rayfield.
Who apologizes? He had to go to the meeting.
Okay.
Speaker.
Thank you. My name is Becky Strickland, and I'm the manager of the Adult Protective Service Unit in Lane County. And we have, this year alone, we have received 5,000 allegations of abuse and neglect. We've been actively involved in the public guardianship program since 1994, when we first conducted our first needs assessment in Lane County. We did one in 94. We followed up with one in 2000, and neither of them went forward. In 2006, we also did a research project, and we identified the most indigent and vulnerable adults with diminished capacity that were at extreme risk for neglect and abuse, and the unmet need that was occurring in Lane County. I served on the governor's appointed task force in 2009, and in 2014, Senate Bill 1553 that provided for a state public guardian and development of a state public guardianship program was unanimously passed. Since the appointment of the Oregon public guardian, great things have been occurring. In 2015 of October, the Lane County high-risk team was conceived and served as a pilot and a model for other parts of the state. The high-risk team serves as a gatekeeper referrals to the Oregon Public Guardian. The protocol has been established to consider and address the health, safety, needs, and rights of vulnerable and dependent adults, residents of Lane County, who are at significant and imminent harm of neglect, abuse, and exploitation. And they're unable to obtain or receive the services and supports needed to eliminate or lessen the risks they face. The mission of the high-risk team is to bring together the various relevant social service and healthcare agencies operating in Lane County in order to provide and facilitate and implement the best and least intrusive alternatives for serving our vulnerable population. This is where the high-risk team has come to make the greatest impact, because an adult at risk may not necessarily need guardianship, but are still in imminent risk of harm and unable to protect themselves due to significant impairments. The high-risk team has been able to divert adults from guardianship by providing high-level case management to utilize a lesser restrictive and less costly alternative to guardianship. We're very proud of the work that we've done the past 18 months. We've staffed 19 highest risk adults. We have had 46 staffings in which the results were able to reduce guardianship. And in only 5 cases were all alternatives ruled out and a referral was made to the Public Guardianship Office.
Thank you, and I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up, and I would encourage you to submit written testimony. We just want to give Mr. Davis a minute or two. We're supposed to adjourn in 35 seconds.
Okay.
So, Mr. Davis, we're happy to stick around for another interview. I apologize, Ms. Strickland. Thank you so much. Mr. Davis.
Members of the committee, co-chairs, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Governor's Commission on Senior Services and the Oregon Disability Commission, as well as United Seniors of Oregon, the Oregon State Council of, for Retired Citizens, state affiliates of the National Council on Aging. As longtime defenders of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office, we come today in very strong support of the Ombudsman. We are asking, at a minimum, that the ombudsman program be funded at continuing levels. With the governor's budget recommendation, they're looking at about a 78% cut, and we want to make sure that with the that they are adequately supported with the additional responsibilities that they have with the public guardian and facilities. As an advocate who's known the long-term care ombudsman program since the 1970s, it is one of the most beloved and cherished programs in the senior and disability communities. Their hundreds of volunteers have made a wonderful impact defending the rights of long-term care residents, and it's a national model and certainly cost-effective and worth the investment. One final thought that I would like to give you is, with the healthy discussion now around creating a state ombudsman office, we need to emphatically reiterate our fervent belief that the long-term care ombudsman remain independent, have their role intact in line with the Older Americans Act, and that they remain publicly appointed by the governor and the legislature. With that said, thank you. We ask for your strong support, and I thank you.
Thank you very much, and I do apologize to everybody whose testimony I had to cut short. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I think with that, we're adjourned.